Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Talking France, a podcast by the local made possible thanks to members. It's gone wild. It's a meltdown. These were just some of the shocked reactions to news that France is in a fair bit of debt and it's getting worse. We'll explain all and how it could affect you, as well as debt. We'll look at wealth and just how much money you have to be considered rich in France. And away from money, we'll reveal a few of France's most beautiful train rides, teach you a little bit about radical French painters, and tell you what's going to change in France this April. So stay tuned to the end. I'm Ben McPartland, your host, and three volunteers who've kindly offered to help this week will be Emma Pearson, Jen Mansfield, and John Litchfield. Hi, guys. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi.
Emma, we've been hit hard by the Jubilé de Mars. What is that? What am I talking about?
March showers. It's funny, in English we say April showers, or certainly in the UK we do. In France they say March showers, and it's those periods of like sudden, very, very heavy rain, and then like 5 minutes later it's sunny again.
Yes, it really has been quite, very cold today, but the Jubilé de Mars have been hitting us hard in France this week. They've even had snow in the Alps. Right, shall we move on? Let's start off with a light subject, shall we? Debt. We need to talk about debt, Emma, because it's all over the French news this week. In fact, been all over the French news, on and off, for years, really. President Emmanuel Macron promised to get the country's finances back on track, but it hasn't quite happened. France is basically spending a lot more than it's earning. And well, that's never a good thing, right, Emma?
It's not, no. And yes, as you say, I'm going to talk about the budget deficit. And honestly, stick with me because it's interesting and it might affect your daily life in France.
Indeed.
So the reason we're talking about all this now is that on Tuesday, it was revealed that the public deficit had jumped to 154 billion euro, which makes up 5.5% of France's gross domestic product. And Pierre Moscovici, who is the head of the Cour des Comptes, which is kind of the highest accounting authority in France, he said that this slippage was major and also very, very rare.
One French economist went a bit further, saying the deficit has gone wild. An opposition senator went even further than that, saying this is a meltdown of France's authority in Europe. Just a bit of economics for dummies, right? Now, when we talk about deficit, it's basically the difference between the income and expenditure of the French government. And it's often expressed as a percentage of the country's GDP, in order to put it in context. Moscovici described it, Emma, as you said, as very, very rare. Is it really that rare?
Well, France is kind of a debt-heavy country, and it has been for a long time. And its national debt now stands at 110% of its GDP. It only outperforms Italy and Greece within the Eurozone. But the thing is, with these like big numbers and concepts like national deficit, to me, it all sounds quite esoteric, and I don't really understand it anyway. But the reason that we're talking about it is that it might affect your daily life in France, in fact, everyone's daily life in France, because of what the government does about it. And previous French governments have kind of tended to shrug and ignore the problem, I think, going right back to the 70s. But now Emmanuel Macron might have to do something about it, not least because the EU's new financial rules say that the deficit should not be more than 3% of GDP. France's, as we said, is now 5.5% and set to grow. And also because ratings agencies have already threatened to downgrade France's rating agencies last summer. And in all fairness, Macron was starting to balance the books in the first half of his term, but then COVID happened and then the war in Ukraine happened, he's kind of been pushed into more big spending. Both he and his finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, have already ruled out tax increases to try and balance the books, which leaves the option of cutting state spending. So Le Maire has already cut 10 billion from the 2024 budget, but the kind of major cuts that will be needed to tackle this financial imbalance are likely to be very unpopular indeed. And France, as we know, is not a country to sort of sit back politely while politicians do things that anger the people.
We can perfectly make savings on public spending without digging into the pockets of the French. That's what Bruno Le Maire had to say about raising taxes. So what's the French government going to do? I think we best turn to our politics expert, John Litchfield, to get an answer to this. John, before I ask you about what Macron, Le Maire and co are going to do, how did France get into this mess in the first place? Is it just really bad with money, John?
Well, you know, it goes back 50 years, literally 50 years. The last time France balanced its state budget was in 1974. What's gone wrong? Well, I mean, essentially, governments of centre-left and centre-right for many years were reluctant to increase taxes even more than they are, and they're already pretty high, but would sort of splurge new spending of various kinds. Interestingly, if you look back over the years, the centre-left has been more cautious and more effective in controlling deficits than the centre-right, who are now screaming against Macron about his mismanagement and so on. But the worst offenders in terms of building deficits have been Chirac, Sarkozy, the centre-right presidents over the years, interestingly. You know, there are many reasons for it. I think the trouble is that the French state spends money on many things which are very necessary. It spends money on many things which are very unnecessary. And no one's ever been willing to really take an axe to these kind of doubtful things which exist in France in terms of state spending and support and don't in other countries which seem to get by especially well. I mean, you can listen. And one of the ones that's always amazed me is the fact that you have all these kind of outposts of national government in every department, two or three in some departments, prefectures and sub-prefectures, people in uniforms, officials busybodying around the place, doing ceremonial as well as bureaucratic activity. And they're basically like sort of little outposts of the national state, almost like colonial outposts in each department, in each big city. Is that really necessary? Why do other countries get away without having it? I mean, the cost is not maybe enormous, not huge. It's about 300 million euros a year, which is, in terms of the present deficit, not huge. But it's an example of how France unthinkingly spends a lot of money that other countries don't, I think.
John, this has fallen on Macron's shoulders now. Far-right opposition leader Jordan Bardella said Macron would have been sacked if he'd been the head of a private company with these kind of numbers. What can Macron do about it?
Politically, it is a problem for Macron in the sense, or also for Macron's would-be successors in the centre, because one of his successful arguments against Le Pen in the last two elections has been her economic incompetence, quite rightly so. But now that argument has been turned against him. You know, you accused us of being economically incompetent, yet you've built up the deficit and so on. People forget that one of the reasons why things spiraled a bit out of control now again is because of all that it takes spending on COVID. Do people think that shouldn't have happened, and all the business should have been allowed to go bust, and then all that it takes spending on trying to soften the blow of the energy inflation after the Ukraine war. France got away with cheaper electricity bills than other countries did, for instance, and also subsidized fuel in their cars and so on. People forget that now. Macron did all that. He's never been very, very keen on deficit reduction. He's always felt that you should reduce deficits by just having the country grow more. It's also going to be very difficult to solve in the next couple of years without France having its international debt ratings reduced, which would then increase the amount it pays for its debt and could send the country into some sort of a Greek spiral of real humiliation.
Well, John, on that question of what the government can do, you know, this is what our listeners will be interested in, how it will affect them, what measures can the government take, and importantly, how angry will this make the French? Could we lead to protests?
Well, I mean, you know, they already have by decree. I mean, the thing is how you do it as well, because, you know, they don't have a majority in the parliament. If they put forward a revised budget, it will be rejected. If they try and impose a revised budget by their emergency powers, as they've done in the past, that could cause a censure motion, which could bring the government down. So Macron and Le Maire, the finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, seem to be steering towards having reductions by decree. Macron seems to hint that what he wants to do is take money not out of the state budget, but out of local government budget, which have already been reduced to the bone. That's going to cause a real shrieking and howling, or tax on the welfare budget. So they do have some power, nevertheless, the government to sort of change the rules about how long people can get unemployment pay, that kind of thing, so which could reduce the amount of money spent on the welfare state, which is about one-third of GDP goes on the French welfare state, a lot of which pensions and things obviously necessary.
You think he'll stick to his promise not to raise taxes? I mean, French pay a lot of taxes anyway, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's something like 43% of French GDP goes on taxes, but it spends 57% of its GDP on the state. So that gap is where the deficit is, McCorbrish, you know, gap. And he's promised not to raise taxes at both elections. They're looking at ways of raising taxes a little bit by stealth, by moving the lines, you know, what point you start paying income tax and levels of income tax, which other governments have done before. So there may be a bit of increased tax revenue through that. But they want to try and get away with having these cuts without going to Parliament. But Parliament, I think, is likely to bring a censure motion anyway at some point this summer. And I suspect we are heading towards a big collision after the European elections in late June or July, when there will be an attempt to pass a censure motion based partly on the deficit problem and other things, which will try and bring the government down. And I think this time, it's failed always in the past, might be a pretty close-run thing this summer.
From debt for dummies to French art for dummies. Emma, you're going to teach me a thing about French impressionist art now. I'm seeing a lot of adverts and articles about French impressionist paintings to the point where I can no longer just ignore this subject. Emma, why are we talking about French impressionists so much in France right now? And more for me, perhaps, than our listeners, who are they again?
Well, we're talking about them because it's the 150th anniversary of the start of the Impressionist School of Art, which began in Paris. And lots of places in France and around the world, actually, are taking the opportunity to run special exhibitions. So this week, probably the biggest one opened at the Musée d'Orsay here in Paris. And what the Musée d'Orsay exhibition in particular is really hoping to show is how radical and even shocking these Impressionists were. Because, you know, these days they're kind of known as middle-of-the-road art, safe, you know, Your granny probably has a set of placemats with Monet's water lilies on. You can buy socks with Van Gogh's sunflowers. And in fact, Van Gogh's Starry Night painting is the second most reproduced painting ever after the Mona Lisa.
Water lilies painting radical?
Yeah, they really were. These artworks at the time were genuinely groundbreaking. And that's why this particular exhibition starts with a virtual reality section. You get a VR headset and you can walk down the streets of Paris in 1874 and go into the event, which is generally agreed to be the birthplace of the Impressionist movement. And basically, this was a small group of artists breaking away from what at the time was mainstream art, epitomised by the annual Salon of big-name artists in Paris. And the Musée d'Orsay exhibition actually includes a couple of examples of these Salon artists, just to show the contrast between what was normal at the time and what the Impressionists did. And the big difference with the Impressionists is that they're kind of not trying to just perfectly recreate what they see. So you get more of these blurry outlines, exaggerated colours, foggy shapes. It's about creating a feeling rather than a snapshot. And it's fair to say that did not go down well with audiences of the day. And in fact, the very unimpressed reaction was what gave the movement its name. A French critic called Louis Leroy, he wrote about Monet's painting Impression, Soleil Levant, which is Impression of a Sunrise. And he said that a preliminary drawing for a wallpaper pattern is more finished than this seascape. Ooh. And it was in fact Leroy who coined Impressionism as the name for the movement, and he intended it very much as an insult. And that painting I just mentioned is now has an estimated value of 300 million euro, which just goes to show that critics know nothing.
That's pretty good revenge for you, isn't it? Can you name a couple of French Impressionist painters for us? See if I know any of these names.
Yeah, well, I mean, Monet, probably the...
What's his first name?
Edouard. No, Claude. Damn, Edouard Manet, Claude Monet.
Edouard Manet, yeah. Manet and Monet, yeah. Any more?
Well, Vincent van Gogh, not actually French, technically, yeah. Dutch, but very much French Impressionist. Camille Pizarro, who was actually born in the Caribbean.
He's on the list, yeah.
French territory at that time.
Pierre-Auguste Renoir. Renoir is famous, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, okay. Very much so. And we should include a lady, Berthe Moreau. She was very much part of this school, and she was an accomplished painter in her own right. She was also painted by some of the Impressionists, and she was perhaps best known as a muse, but she's been kind of rediscovered in recent years, and there's a very good exhibition of her work in Paris right now.
Okay, mentioning exhibitions, Emma, for this Festival of French Impressionists, it's not just in Paris that all these events are taking place?
No, there's absolutely loads of them. I mean, they're around the world, really, but they're definitely around France. The Musée d'Orsay one that I mentioned runs in Paris until July 14th, and then it transfers to the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., where it runs to the end of the year. In France themselves, there are special exhibitions at locations where the Impressionists themselves painted, such as Monet's gardens out at Giverny, which are beautiful and well worth a visit anytime, and the port of Honfleur in Normandy, which is a really pretty picturesque little place that Impressionists love to paint. Dozens of museums all over France have exhibitions. So there's the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Marseille, the Palais des Beaux-Arts in Lille, and the one that I think sounds most interesting, actually, is the Musée d'Art Roger Quilliot, which is in Clermont-Ferrand in the Auvergne area, and it's focusing on how Impressionists dealt with snow. It's a snow-themed one because Clermont is a mountainous area.
All right, just going back to this idea that Parisians kind of hated these Impressionist painters when they first came out. Is that a kind of Parisian trait? We've picked out three famous landmarks that Parisians hated at the beginning. Do you want to start us off, Emma?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most famous one of them all is the Eiffel Tower. Mm. Now, absolutely, the symbol of Paris.
Wasn't always like that.
Very much no. It was originally intended just as a temporary structure for the 1889 World Fair, which was held in Paris. But yes, it was widely hated by Parisians. In fact, a group of famous artists wrote an open letter to the newspaper protesting about how ugly it was. The novelist Guy de Maupassant called it this high and skinny pyramid of iron ladders, this giant ungainly skeleton upon a base that looks built to carry a colossal monument of cyclops, but which just peters out into a ridiculous thin shape like a factory chimney. Another artist was a bit more brutal. He called it a hole-ridden suppository. Once it was actually opened, de Maupassant reportedly had lunch in the tower almost every day because he said it was the only place in Paris that he didn't have to look at it. Although actually that's rubbish because there's loads of places in Paris that you can't see it and you could just go out to the suburbs, but that wouldn't make such a good story.
Okay, and one more recent that we've picked out. I remember this fuss about this.
This was the glass pyramid at the Louvre. So the glass pyramid in the courtyard of the Louvre, it's a work of art, but it's also very practical because it actually acts as the entrance to the museum. You go in through the glass pyramid and then you go underground, and all of the sort of admin areas and the areas that link up the three wings are all underground, so it's a bit tidier. The pyramid itself is now one of the most famous objects in Paris, absolute staple of tourist selfies. But when it opened in 1989, yes, as you said, people absolutely hated it. The newspaper Le Figaro ran a campaign against it. And according to the polls that the newspaper ran, 90% of Parisians were against the idea at the time.
Yeah.
It was designed by the Chinese-American architect I.M. Pei. Mm. He was invited personally by then President François Mitterrand to redesign the museum's entrance. I don't think he quite realised what he was up against. I read a piece where he was recalling a 1984 meeting with the French Historic Monuments Commission. This meeting ended in uproar. Pei was not even able to present his ideas, and the officials shouted at him, "You are not in Dallas now."
Wow, it's fair to say it's fairly well loved now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Part of the scene.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it's very stunning, but it's also very practical because it's taken all the sort of the queues and the messy admin of the museum underground. People love to be photographed next to it.
And one, I think this is probably my favourite building in Paris, the Sacré-Cœur, but it's got a very controversial past, has it not?
Yeah, this one is weird to me. It's still controversial among some people. It's on the hilltop of Montmartre. It offers absolutely some of the best views in the city. But it is quite widely disliked by Parisians, and they nickname it the Alabaster Wedding Cake. I think partly it's because it is a relatively recent addition to the city. It's not as old as it looks at all. It was started in 1875 and opened in 1919. And the 19th century author Émile Zola called it a slap in the face of reason and something that was built to glorify the absurd. It's a bit of a theme here of like writers hating on new stuff, isn't there? But these days, plenty of Parisians will still solemnly tell you that it's ugly. The other reason that people don't like it, especially people on the political left, is that it was built on the Montmartre Hill, which was a key site for the Paris Commune, which is a kind of popular uprising that took place in 1871. But because of these two things, Sacré-Cœur was only actually given official historic monument status in 2022, just two years ago.
And probably one building that is probably still hated, always has been, is the Tower of Montparnasse.
Oh, well, that really is ugly.
Although I think they even market it as, it's the best place in Paris where you don't actually have to look at the Tour de Montparnasse.
Yeah, it's true. But actually, because the tour is kind of ugly and hated, it's often cited as the reason that Paris doesn't have any other skyscrapers, that it's kind of kept its old school skyline.
Well, it also has a really nice restaurant at the top that gives you a lovely view of another tower, the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah,
so
it does offer incredible views around Paris, has to be said.
True.
Thank you, Emma. Now, France has beautiful scenery, mountains, valleys, forests, rugged coastlines and rolling hills, and it has around 27,000 kilometres of rail lines, which means there are probably some pretty spectacular rail journeys to be taken in France. We'll hear about some shortly, but first, the bad news. One of the most scenic rail routes, nicknamed the Train of Wonders, is set to close for more than a year for a major renovation project. Tell us a bit more about this train line, Jen.
So we're talking about the train from Nice to Tende, or the Train de Merveille in French. And it's part of the regional TER train network in the Alpes-Maritimes Département in southern France along the Italian border. So this train line is special because it goes through some of France's most picturesque mountain landscapes from Nice to the Mercantour National Park. And in the 2.5-hour journey, you start off in the Mediterranean city of Nice, and then you pass through these small villages, you go by cliffs and valleys, and eventually you end up in the mountains. But if you want to ride this train, you're going to have to pay around 15 euro for a ticket. And you'll need to do so before September, because on September 2nd, it's going to close for 16 months for major renovations.
Why is it closed exactly, Jen?
Well, the main focus of the work is going to be refurbishing part of the route that passes through the Brousse Tunnel, which runs between Thuée de l'Escarène and Sospel. Over the years, and thanks to a lot of storms, the walls have become infiltrated with water, and that's caused limestone deposits to form. So basically, they have a lot of intense work to do with fixing that tunnel. And then they also want to replace one of the bridges that the train crosses over, and they want to lay new tracks to replace the old ones.
So if you're visiting the Riviera this summer, it's well worth checking out that train line before it closes for over a year. Right, any more picturesque, beautiful, extraordinary train journeys in France you'd recommend, Jen?
So there are two that I would highly recommend, and they're both named after colors. There's the yellow train and the red train.
Sounds like something at Disneyland.
Yeah, it does. The yellow train, or the Trajon, goes through the Pyrénées Orientales Département. And it takes you through forests, gorges, viaducts, and old fortresses and monasteries. Plus, you can take their historic train that in the summer sometimes runs with open carriages, which is really cool. So you kind of get the full view all around you. The official name of that train is the Ligne de Sardaigne, and it's part of their local TER system. Right now, it's actually undergoing some works, but it'll be open again at the end of April. So you can do it in the summer at the end of spring. And then there's the red train, and that's also through the mountains, but the other mountains, the Alps. And it's formally referred to as the Train du Mountain Vert. This train is bright red. It goes through the Chamonix Valley, and it goes around Mont Blanc before stopping at the Mer de Glace Glacier. You can do it all year round, even in the summer, which is really cool to see the glacier in the summer. And it's about 39 euro a person, but you have to book on the Chamonix website. It's not part of the local SNCF infrastructure. And then there's another one that comes highly recommended. If you're a fan of Côte d'Azur, you can take the SNCF's Marseille-Ventimiglia line, and that goes from Marseille to Nice, and you enjoy a lot of the seaside views as you go along the Riviera. You see the resorts like Cannes and Antibes, plus some of the smaller cute villages along the way. I have to say that really any trains around the Marseille area are gorgeous. Even the Paris to Marseille train ride is really pretty during the last little bit. I've also taken a regional train from Aix-en-Provence to Avignon in June, and that was really lovely.
Let's bring in John briefly now. John, you've been on a few train rides in France. Have you got a favourite for us, John?
The one I would point to is one I did 5 years ago, which is a sort of a 270-kilometre long branch line, or about 150 miles, I think, like the sort of distance between Manchester and London, which goes from a village in the Auvergne down to the sea at Béziers, and really goes through pretty well nowhere, but it goes through some of the most beautiful country in France, and not only goes through different regions, it goes almost through different climates. The guard on the train I was in said that it can be winter on one train journey on the tops of the Auvergne hills, and then by the time you get down into the Mediterranean plain, you're in summer, and that's, you know, quite common on that train. It used to be a kind of secondary main line that brought people up from the Mediterranean coast to Paris, but that all sort of stopped years ago, and there's just one train a day that completes the whole line now. It costs you 70 euros return from a village called Neussag in the Cantal down to Béziers, nearly on the coast. And frankly, there's no reason why there should be a train between those two places, and there were maybe 30 people on the train when I was on it, mostly people going to sort of getting off at small stations and going walking in the hills. Extraordinarily beautiful.
Thank you. Sounds like we'll have to take that train before they close it down. Emma, anything from you? Any favourite train journeys?
Yeah, I mean, I always like going through the Alps. So if you go from Paris to either Switzerland or Italy, you go through the Alps. But I think my favourite has to be that stretch between Marseille and Nice, because you just run right along the coastline. I've done it a couple of times on the normal daytime TGV, but this summer we also took the night train down there. And about 7 in the morning, I sort of woke up and went out into the corridor, pulled up the shade, and all of a sudden there was the sea right in front of me, bright blue, beautiful sunshine. It was a really special moment.
Special times. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, John. So we were talking about money earlier, and France itself, despite its debt problems that we referred to, is a pretty rich country. The 7th biggest economy in the world, in fact. And there's a few rich people here. The world's richest man is French, Bernard Arnault, the head of the luxury goods giant LVMH. But how much money do you need to be considered rich in France? Emma, are you going to help us out with this question?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to try and compete with Bernard Arnault, you'll need roughly 230 billion euro.
Oof, okay.
Bit of a... bit of a challenge. Okay, something more relatable. The average monthly take-home pay after tax for a full-time employee in France is around €2,000. So that works out at €24,000 a year after tax. Obviously, there are various different markers to measure wealth, and most of the super rich are not really reliant on a monthly salary. But France's national statistics body, INSEE, suggests that in order to be in the top 1% of earners in France, you will need at least €10,000 per month. And that's after paying taxes and social charges, which can be pretty steep in France. So we're probably talking about €15,000 a month gross. Coming down a level, to be in the top 10% of earners, you'll need take-home pay of €4,107 a month. And in order to be in the top quarter, you need €3,000 a month or more. And there's an independent body called the Observatoire des Inégalités. And according to their calculations, if you want to be considered rich in France, a single person with no dependents should take home more than €3,860 per month. Down at the other end of the scale, that same single person would be considered poor if they had less than €965 per month to live on, according to the Observatoire's calculations. And I mean, those figures to get into the top 1% and the top 10% are roughly the same for the UK. But in order to get into the top 1% of earners in the US, you would need six times the amount as in France. You would need roughly €60,000 per month. And in order to get into the top 10% of earners in the US, you need just over three times the French amount, or €13,000 a month.
Like you say, it's different in different countries. Now, how much money you have in your pocket is probably only half the story, Emma. What about how much you need to live well or comfortably in France?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. France, in global terms, is a fairly low-wage economy. The average annual salary in France is just over half the average annual salary in the US, and French workers are pretty highly taxed. But those taxes that you pay do some pretty cool things. So, for example, French workers don't really need to worry about medical bills in the same way that US workers do. Likewise, labour laws means that it's quite hard to get fired in France. And if you do, there's a fairly generous system of unemployment benefits. Likewise, when you retire between the age of 62 and 64, you will have a reasonably generous state-backed pension. And it's not just the sort of things in case of emergency. There are all sorts of things in France that are at least partially subsidised by the state. So, for example, if you have young children, the cost of a creche or a childminder is worked out according to your salary rather than being a flat rate. So if you earn less, you pay less. And lots of different things. If you want to try a different profession, for example, the state will probably pay for you to retrain as well. Now, I mean, obviously, that doesn't mean there are no expenses. And in Paris, in particular, the rent can be insane. And in rural France, you'll almost certainly have to run a car because public transport is pretty sketchy once you get out of the cities. But when we talk to people who've made the move to France from other countries, especially from the US, the theme that quite often comes up is that they have less money here, but they don't really feel like they need as much. They have other things like a better quality of life, time spent with their families, a better work-life balance.
People often say the French work to live rather than live to work. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. There are certainly plenty of French people who are keen on money. Our mate Bernard, for example, he probably didn't waste too many hours smelling the roses and having long lunches while he was building that €230 billion fortune. And I mean, obviously, it's not like capitalism doesn't exist in France. There are adverts and shops everywhere trying to sell you stuff. But I think it is also true that the French attitude to money is perhaps a little different. I think being rich is not seen as an end in itself for most people. Simply being rich isn't something to aspire to. Like, people might say they want to earn some money so they can retire early, for example, but they're not trying to be rich just for the sake of being rich. And boasting about how much money you have probably won't go down too well with most French people. In fact, the French term un richard for a wealthy person is definitely pejorative. It means someone who has wealth but no class. And actually, the wealthiest French people usually won't be seen with loads of designer label clothes or driving a brand new sports car. If you head down to Île de Ré in the summer, which is where the wealthiest Parisians all have their second homes, they sometimes call it like the French version of the Hamptons. If you have a look around there, you'll do well to spot many obvious signs of wealth among those second homeowners there, despite them clearly all being very rich, because even a holiday cottage there will set you back about €1 million.
Let's bring in John again briefly here. John, is there any truth in this idea that the French have a mistrust of wealth, or the idea that it's okay in France to be wealthy as long as you don't flaunt it?
Well, there is, I suppose, don't talk about money. It does seem to be a French characteristic more so, certainly than, in the US. you know, I lived in the US there, and you know, everything in America is counted in money, even something like the golf competitions. The points by which you decide how well golfers do is the amount of money they earn. It's sort of a sort of badge of pride that you can never imagine that happening in that way in France. You know, money is as you say, either a taboo subject or in some ways slightly shameful. I think the French, you know, like money as much as the rest of us do, but there is a sort of revolutionary, anti-rich, anti-successful sort of mood, which goes through, surprisingly through not just the sort of working classes as far as they still exist, but right through French society. There is a sort of, I think, an anti-money, anti-success, anti-rich attitude, more so in France than other countries. I think that is true.
Okay, a new month is almost upon us. It's April, which means a few things change in France. And there's a few important dates coming up. School holidays, for a start, are in April, Jen, although it depends on where you are in France, because they're all split into zones. Tell us what else is changing this month.
Well, there are a few things. The first one concerns motorists. If you drive in France starting on April 1st, you no longer have to show the green proof of insurance sticker on your windshield. This is because law enforcement will be able to access your insurance information using an online database called the FAV, and that updates every 72 hours. So basically, the goal is just to go digital. If you're worried that for whatever reason your insurance information might not be registered online, then you can actually check. We've got a frequently asked questions article on our website to find the link for that, and pretty easy, honestly.
I'll share that article in the show notes.
Yes, and then taxes are the next big April event. So the online portal for income tax declarations will open on April 11th on the French tax site impots.gouv.fr. If you're wondering, does this apply to me, and you spend most of the year living in France, or you have any income in France, including rental income, then the odds are very strong that you do have to fill out that declaration. Luckily, doing taxes in France is relatively painless if you've done them before, especially on the online system, because that remembers your information from the last time, so it's not too complicated. Just don't forget that you do have to declare your foreign bank accounts, even the ones that just have a few dollars or pounds in them. And April also marks the end of the trêve hivernale. That's basically the end of the winter truce. It's the rule that says you can't evict people during the cold winter months, even if they stop paying their rent.
Okay. What about some fun events in April in France, Jen? Anything on the cultural calendar we should tell listeners about?
Oh, there are a few fun festivals during the month of April. There's the Foire au Jambon, for example, and you can guess that that's all about ham. It starts on the 4th and goes to the 7th. It happens every year in Bayonne, in Basque country. And yeah, it's all about famous hams from the area and every stage of their creation. Probably not the most vegetarian-friendly environment, though. So if you're looking for an alternative, there's also a music festival, the Printemps de Bourges, which happens in central France, and that runs from the 23rd to the 28th. They usually have a pretty diverse range of music, so there's something for everybody. This year, it will feature artists like Clara Luciani, Beatrice Dahl, Mika, and Chaka Punk, though admittedly, I don't know any of those names. Do you, Ben?
Chaka Punk rings a bell.
You must know Mika, surely. He's on like every French TV program that exists.
Okay. Is there anything in April that you pair are looking forward to?
Well, I'm really
looking... Once the Jubilee of Mars is passed.
I'm really looking forward to the extension of the Café Terrasse. That's in Paris, and it happens every year at the start of April. About 1 in 5 Parisian restaurants pay the extra money to extend their outdoor terraces further onto the sidewalks, which is very nice. It really feels like the start of summer. And this year, the exciting thing is that in July, the terrasse will be able to stay open until midnight. Usually, they have to close down at 10 p.m., so that's exciting.
Olympics related?
Yeah, of course, it's Olympics related. And there are a couple other things, though, that we can look forward to at the start of April. For example, this weekend, we have a long weekend. Monday is off.
April the 1st.
Yes, exactly, for Easter Monday.
However, we are bitter, as we are every year at this time of year, because we don't get Good Friday off. What's the reason again, Emma?
Well, it's kind of complicated. It's to do with Napoleon and French secularism, also a bit to do with war. I wrote a really long article on it.
Right, so I'll share that article in the show notes as well. But we do not get Good Friday off, even though most of our colleagues around Europe do. And Poisson d'Avril, what am I talking about here?
April Fool's Day.
Yeah. Does French celebrate it?
Yeah, you can like play a joke on someone and say Poisson d'Avril. And
you normally stick a fish on their back. That's what the kids do anyway, to me. Okay, Emma, are you looking forward to anything in April?
Well, actually, this has already started, but it continues into April. So if anyone's in the Paris region, I really recommend checking out the listings for the Banlieue Blues Festival. This is like a 6-week long festival in the suburbs around Paris. It's just a series of concerts. They carry on through into April. I saw a really great group of French Malian singers last week who were really interesting and really different. And they've got all sorts of good stuff. So I recommend people check out Banlieue Blues.
Sounds well worth checking out. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. And thanks to John, as usual. That brings us to the end of this week's episode of Talking France. We'll be back again next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.